Hey folks, this is Craig from Asset Horizon and Inner Experience, which is today's episode. There are too many links and too many things going on, so navigate to the show notes to check out the links of Nicholas Bruno, who is our guest today, and everything that we have going on in 2023 at Asset Horizon. Okay, let's get started.
Inner Experience.
Welcome to Your Inner Experience, the shadowy sibling podcast of Asset Horizon, where we host little curios on topics which are sometimes thought to be adjacent to philosophy, but involve trysts with psychology, religion, the occult, and the possibility of something we might call inner experience. Today, I'm very excited to host our guest, Nicholas Bruno, a photographer and creator of a wonderful tarot deck called the Somnia Tarot, which features haunting and provocative portrayals of encounters with figures either seen in or inspired by the history of his sleep paralysis. Now, as many of our listeners know, last year I created a tarot deck called the Philosopher's Tarot, a project which so many of you graciously supported. And during that time, I went to many places for inspiration, but it wasn't until I concluded my tarot deck and had a chat with Eitan Ilfield, the owner of Watkins Books in London, who was also an important person when it came to creating this deck, who introduced me to this fascinating little blue box, which contains the images we're about to discuss today. Now, during the course of my project, of course, I came across many different tarot decks, which revealed to me the absolute abundance of tarot creations in the world today. However, when I was introduced to Nicholas' deck, something was moved in me. First, I knew right away that I needed to have this deck in my possession, and I'm not ordinarily the kind of person who's given over to that sort of rapturous want of something. But as Eitan revealed to me the backstory of the deck, I learned that Nicholas and I share something far more profound. I discovered that the inspiration behind the photographs that depict the 78 images we find in the Smith-Waite Tarot were inspired by his regular, terrifying experiences of sleep paralysis. Now, this is something that I also experienced regularly as a child and occasionally as an adult. But in my case, I've always kept it secret. Not even my parents knew that I had these experiences. But once I saw the images in the deck, it was almost as if my personal unconscious was hacked and something resonated. And we'll get into my experiences later. But first, I must introduce you to Nicholas Bruno. Nicholas, welcome to Inner Experience and Asset Horizon.
Thank you so much for having me. So awesome.
Nicholas, could you just give us a little introduction to you and your work and tell us what are some of the important details that I left out about you, your journey, and your creative process?
Sure. Yeah, I'm an artist based in Long Island, New York. I work in the mediums of photography, sculpture, costume design, you name it. And what I do as a therapy is I create these surreal self-portraits based on my sleep paralysis experiences. I've been doing this for multiple years, and it's given me control over this condition that otherwise I had no control over.
Could you talk about, there's so much to talk about. First, let's just talk about the tarot. Well, when I purchased your deck, it also had this companion book, which I picked up too. And it mentions somewhere in the book, or maybe in a few places, that one of your elder female relatives was significant insofar as they kind of stoked your sensitivity to what we might call the mystical or the spiritual. Is that true? Maybe tell us about that person.
Sure. Yeah. So I grew up in a Greek Orthodox household, and a lot of the superstitions that were given to me came from my great grandmother. We call her Yaya, which is great grandmother or grandmother in Greek. So I learned a lot from my grandma, who told me stories of her and all of these different superstitions and traditions that came from her. And I always saw her as this, I guess, a spiritual figure as a child, because she was someone who was not in my life, but I knew so much about, and she's transcended to the other side. So I imagined her in heaven and her like passing on these traditions to me as a little kid. Some of the traditions were awesome, like baking bread for New Year's, and we use like a special family recipe. Or there are terrifying ones that kind of got to me as a kid and gave me a little bit of trauma, where it's like, you're not supposed to sweep out dust at night out because it can bring in bad energy, or if a bird flies into a window, someone might get sick or die. So like being a little kid, like trying to figure out spirituality, I was a little confused and scared, but also intrigued at the same time. So that was my intro with that.
Yeah, the way that I imagine it based on your telling of it is that there was a moment where you went rummaging through some stuff and maybe you landed upon the tarot deck. What kind of tarot deck did she have, and what was that experience like?
So I spent a lot of time at my grandma's house, and I loved going through all her old stuff in the basement. That's where I would hang out as a kid, like antique trains and stuff. So I'd go into her storage room, and one day I found a little blue box, a tarot deck, on shelves in her storage closet. And I was looking through them, and my grandma came down, and she's like, no, don't touch that. She took it from me, and she hid it up on the high shelf in the storage thing. And I was like, okay, well, as soon as she goes upstairs, I'm going to go back up there. So I would climb up and grab it and look at the cards. And that's my earliest memory of tarot. And that memory always stuck with me. And just the fact that there was something so mystical hidden in this storage unit of curiosities, that really just got my imagination going.
Not that this is completely relevant, but it does attend to my story of sleep paralysis. My parents, or my mom, had gone to beauty school, and she had a mannequin head in the house. And my dad used to just come in and like pop that head on top of his turtleneck and like poke through the door. It would be at the foot of my bed. It was just terrifying. They knew I was scared of it, and they put it anywhere they didn't want me to like rummage through stuff. And that head comes back in my experiences. So it's interesting. I couldn't get to the tarot deck if there was one. But let's talk about the sleep paralysis. Now, just given my own experience with it, like, I'll just say this. It's, you know, like anything like this could be a sensitive topic insofar as you say that it's terrifying. When I have experienced this sort of thing, it is very terrifying. But in the morning, it's almost as if like that experience just evaporated. But maybe you have a different sort of experience with it. When did it start? What's the history of it? Yeah, go ahead.
So as a child, I remember having experiences as young as like 5 or 6 years old where I'd wake up and I can't move and I'd feel like a presence in the room. And a figure would walk through and maybe walk to the side of my bed and be looking out the window. And me being a little kid having nightmares all the time, I kind of brushed it off as just another nightmare. So in high school, I was like 14, 15 years old. And it started happening, sleep paralysis started happening every single night for me, almost every single night. And I would wake up paralyzed and there would be a figure at the foot of my bed or floating above my bed or bursting my door open. And I'm trying to look and see who's standing in the doorway, but I can't. And the figure would be screaming in my ear. I'd hear like a low humming static, or I would hear them say stuff. I can't figure out what language it's in or anything like that. I was completely perplexed, terrified, and I was afraid to tell anybody because it's a nightmare, but it's something different. It's like a living nightmare. You're directly entering this world between the world of being awake and asleep. You have no control over what goes on. So growing up in a superstitious household, here I am as a 15-year-old kid. I'm afraid to tell my parents because of all superstitions that my great-grandmother passed on to us. So I did eventually tell them, and they had a priest come to my house and run around the house and throw holy water all over my things. I loved heavy metal at the time, so I had all the heavy metal posters in my room, and the priest comes in and just splashes all the heavy metal posters with holy water. That in itself, even though they were trying to help me, it still made the situation even more perplexing and real. Like, am I possessed by a demon? Is this something that is the house haunted, you know? So it was difficult to deal with at that time.
Did you at any point ever go to like a traditional therapist or a counselor, either through the school or, you know, in a private practice?
I never did. The reason why is once I found that art class was kind of my safe haven in high school, I was failing every other class because I was falling asleep during class generally. I wouldn't sleep for like maybe 2 days at a time because I was so afraid to go back to bed. But going into those art classes made me feel like I had some sort of control and I could let loose, go on the computer, grab a camera and explore that. And that kind of became my therapy in a way. My teacher at the time told me why I told him about my sleep disorder or what was happening to me. And he suggested to keep a dream journal, but a visual one, like a sketchbook. after a month of exploring this, I had a whole sketchbook full of characters that I've seen, full of situations, how I felt. Was I feeling like I'm drowning? Was there an immense pressure on my chest? And all that was in this sketchbook. And I began to create these self-portraits. And that really became the key to taking control over the situation and really sharing it with the world.
I think having that as a sort of living artifact, almost like a talisman in a way, you know, it's not only a way to work through it, but I mean, in my case, I was so young that I had stuffed animals, and like I would actually create almost like a hierarchy and ranking of like animals who would defend my bed. And so when I went out to like a carnival or something like that, I rarely thought about the sleep paralysis experience in waking life, except when I saw a stuffed animal. To me, that was like, oh, there's another guardian for my troop. And so I want to talk about, and I want to get everyone else in the conversation too, but maybe we can kind of compare notes on this, because in my sleep paralysis experience, there's, like you said, it's almost like this overlap between the waking world and the world of sleep. And in there's a kind of moment, it's almost like a drum being hit or like a sheet of metal. And there's an absolute clarity. It's almost like darkness meets light, but things are illuminated, but somehow still dark. And I always had like a smell. It's like, I can't even like tell you what the smell was, except to say that my nose was so sensitive in those instances and my body completely frozen. And it always felt as if somebody was like kind of poked up against my ear, like a face was just right there. And I just couldn't turn and see it, among other things that I saw. But can you describe, like, is your bodily experience, or was your bodily experience, similar to mine in any way?
Absolutely. Especially the heightened sensitivity that you described, waking up and trying to move just even like the tip of my finger was impossible and still is impossible. And I'm frozen in bed. My body, I can't move it. I can move my eyes maybe a little bit or use my peripheral vision, but I'll hear auditory hallucinations such as the screaming or the static that I'll hear. I'll see figures that are appearing in my room. I've never smelled anything like you've said, but I've heard a lot of strange noises, voices, all of that. And it can be really alarming because it feels like there's somebody, again, right next to your ear, yelling into your ear, and you can't do anything about it.
That's right. I'm going to let the others maybe get a word in edgewise, because I could go for hours with this. Adam or Will, do you have anything?
Well, what I think is just really fascinating on a conceptual level with Giorgio's sleep paralysis. And you can extend this into other sort of, not afflictions, but forms of experience. I mean, the main conceptual thing that I'm sort of getting is liminality. The idea of, it's a meme now, but the idea of a liminal space, a space in which it sits itself, a threshold between two others. I mean, let's go to my personal experience. It wasn't sleep paralysis, but I used to have epilepsy, one of those ones you kind of grow out of. And any sort of fit would occur, particularly in that one space between waking up and being asleep. It is in that transitional phase in which, some circuits of consciousness, as Timothy Leary and Metzger would say it, or, some aspects of the brain are kicking into gear again, or reorganizing themselves to, rather than being sort of an imaginative state of free play, going on to playing some role in this piloting, this meat machine we call the body. And I find it interesting, the idea that sleep paralysis occurs in this liminal space, in this transitory period. And it's almost like there are aspects, or to go back to some of our conversations on previous episodes of Grant Maxwell, potencies, powers of personality in a multifaceted way of experiencing what we habitually unify as just one thing, ourself, and having all these different things competing for our attention, competing for, in a way, kind of dominance over the conscious waking life. Is the sleep paralysis experience exclusively in regarding limits, boundaries, and being stuck within those ambiguous spaces between the unconscious and the conscious? And I'm wondering, in the project of translating that into an artwork, is the therapeutic aspect, would you say it could be something akin to translating this unconscious liminality, actually, putting it inside of the waking world, and therefore sort of capturing it in a way in the artwork itself?
That's an interesting thought. Yeah, I consider it a very esoteric experience, being able to dive into my subconscious or allow my subconscious to kind of bleed into reality in a way, even though I don't have full control to interact with it unless I'm having an out-of-body experience or lucid dreaming. It's really unique to be able to explore that. And like you said, bring these ideas or concepts from this world between being awake and asleep, and then putting them into a frame, a photograph, and then being able to share that with more conscious people who can resonate and say, hey, I've seen that figure too, or hey, I felt that exact way too, and this is how I saw it. And that could be with somebody in Mexico, in Germany, anywhere around the world. People have been experiencing sleep paralysis and seeing these shadow-like figures from now all the way back to whatever time period you choose. It's been a uniquely human thing. And we, not knowing why we're able to experience this, it's so intriguing and important. And I've made it my mission to, again, just explore my subconscious through these sleep paralysis experiences and making artwork about them to start a dialogue and figure out why we see these figures. Like, is there a biological mechanism to it? Is there something, another plane that we can't see that some people can see on that strange cusp of sleep and consciousness? It's really fun exploration.
I mean, so I'm not going to ask the pathological questions, but but I am interested in certain aspects of your work, in as much as like there's a kind of really, maybe other people will resonate with this, because like I'm not great at articulating interpretive gestures when it comes to like artwork, but there's a kind of strange eeriness to the clarity of the photography on display here, especially in the use of contrast. So I'm wondering, like, when I first, a few days ago, when I first took a look at your work, like the first thing that hit me was actually like René Magritte.
Yeah.
Not actually. Yeah. So I'm wondering, like, can you speak to, like, I know this is a generic question, but can you speak to, you know, movements or periods of expression that have resonated with you, particularly in the way in which you try to translate experiences into artistic gestures or expressions or utilizations of photography? Like, sure. where does your influence intercept your experience?
So at first it was just me, my camera, and I would go out and explore and just make these self-portraits, whether it be in an abandoned building somewhere or in my own backyard, I'd make a set. And once I started studying art in high school and in college, I would look at like the romanticists, where they would, like, for example, Caspar David Friedrich is one of my favorite painters. Mm-hmm. And I love René Magritte. So looking at their work and how they compose these really interesting paintings that pack a punch with symbolism, but they're also simple at the same time, I want to figure out, how can I do that with my photography? How can I make my photographs appear in the painting landscape? So I kind of work like a painter in a way, where I pick my scene, I set that up, my camera's on a tripod, and I build out the layers of the photograph, where I'm setting up the props first in one layer, and then I'm maybe going in one costume, posing as one character while my camera's shooting on a timer. And then I change my costume again and become the antagonist, for example. And I'm creating these layers to the image, and it allows me to kind of work by myself with no help, or if I have help, they're behind the scenes. And it's a different type of process than just clicking a photograph. Mm-hmm. It allows me to have my control over every part of the image. And then I can go in and create like a painterly touch in post, where I'm not cutting and pasting, but I'm layering these images on top of each other, creating the final composition, just as a painter would go take their blank canvas, sketch it out. They would do the underpainting and then paint right on top of that. And then they have their finished product.
But there's kind of a mise-en-scène to your work that I really appreciate, just as a neophyte. I don't really know anything about this practice. But yeah, another element here that I wanted to touch on is, like, there tends to be like a lot of work with like the figure. Like there's a strange sort of, again, with the clarity of these images, there's like a really intense centrality of the figures, and yet they're extremely obscured. Like they're often, you know, cloaked, right? Or, you know, darkened. So I'm wondering, like, what relation to like the body do you have in your work on photography? Because some of that actually reminds me of a set of photographs done by Irv Guibert in the early 70s with the cloaked figures, right, where that obscures all the particular detail. Like, I'm wondering, does this pertain at all to some of the relations that you have to yourself as it pertains to sleep paralysis? Does your representation of the body reflect some of what you're talking about regarding sleep paralysis?
Right. So I use a lot of anonymity in my work for a number of reasons. One of them being I want my viewer to be able to place themselves in these situations. So it's not just a photo of my face doing something in a dream. It's a cloaked figure, or maybe they're blindfolded, or their identity is obscured by their hair, for example. It allows the human body to become more of a sculpture and a motif rather than like, this is a photograph of me or a photograph of my sister. It allows people to just jump into the situation. Like, for example, the image behind me where that's the card for the emperor, where we have a character here with an anvil above his head and he's sitting in this throne. Like, you can put yourself in that situation because he's shrouded in this long bedsheet. But also what I like to do with these shrouded figures is that's how they kind of appear to me in my sleep paralysis from experiences. Now, I see these spiritual looking figures. They're like apparitions, or I can't see what their face is. They're often faceless. And I use what other than bed sheets from the sleep experience. I sew these bed sheets together and cover my characters in them. And it brings another element from the physical experience of sleep paralysis into the artwork. And that's interwoven throughout all of the work, like especially a lot of them have ropes around their necks, and the rope symbolizes the feeling I get when I'm choking and I can't breathe during sleep paralysis. Mm-hmm. Or the anvil, for example, having that weight on my chest or feeling like something's about to crash down on me. Or if my characters are halfway submerged in the water, I use water as the subconscious and above the water as the conscious. And they're often halfway submerged. So they're stuck between these two worlds. Either they're climbing up out of ladders, they're emerging, they're submerging themselves. So it's been building this visual vocabulary and tying that with my dream journal has been a really cool process. And it's helped me express myself in ways I never thought I could. And also to tell stories, because I'm not a linguist or anything like that, but I can definitely weave together a bunch of stuff that I create and put it into a photograph.
The drapery and the facial coverings were what really caught my attention right away, because like you said, well, in my case, as maybe a child of 4 or 5 years old, one of the figures that kept coming back in my sleep paralysis episodes was a man in kind of a bowler hat, but he was wrapped up like the Invisible Man. And so when I saw that right away, I was just like, well, this is it. This guy's tapped in. And then later on, maybe, you know, when I was an adult, maybe in my late 20s or thereabouts, I have a very distinct image of just a shrouded woman standing in my room. Now, there was one instance where I had a sleep paralysis episode and I can only open my eyes and I saw the woman in the room and I had to convince myself that that's there. That's part of this episode. When I wake up again, that woman will not be back. But then there was one instance in which I opened my eyes again. And the woman was still there. And it was one of the freakiest things I've ever experienced. And I'll say this, and I don't know if there's like a trigger warning for this or not. I mean, I don't think there is, but I had an incident in subsequent nights where I saw a billow of bald smoke just kind of traveling around my room and, you know, going up and down in the corners. And then the more I focused on it, the closer it got, and it came to the side of the bed with me. And the more I continued to focus, and it materialized into the shape of like a small humanoid. And I saw it put its arms up to touch my leg, and it was a young boy's voice, and it just said, "Play with me."
Wow.
And that was like one of the most bone-chilling episodes that I've ever had of sleep paralysis and other things, slamming doors. Like, I don't know if you said something about like hearing a noise, but one time I saw a woman. I had a girlfriend years ago, and she didn't live with me. She lived out of state. But when she came to visit me, she would come into my bedroom and she would see the door to the little lavatory I had. And she just absolutely insisted that I keep that door closed. And I don't know, I'm the kind of person who just like leaves the door open. That's like my major bad habit. And, you know, she wasn't there one night, but one night during one of my episodes, I woke up. And sure enough, there's a woman standing in the doorway and she just screams at me, keep the door closed, and the door slams.
Wow.
These could be dreams. These could be hallucinations. Nonetheless, this was the experience that was recorded. But anyway, I don't know. Are your experiences similar like that? Like, what are the figures that tend to appear most? Like men, women, children? I mean, clearly they're indistinct in the deck, but like, is there a common trope that reappears in your episodes?
So what you described in yours were two very stereotypical archetypes that people see in sleep paralysis, which are the hatted man and the old hag, I would say, which is like in a dress who's often shrouded. She could either be an older woman or maybe just a woman in a dress. You can't really see what her face looks like. Right. And were two archetypes that I've seen often. As long as like, if I can see what's happening in the dream and I can pinpoint where they are in the room, I try to figure out what that archetype is. Is it the hatted man? Is it the old hag? Is it somebody who has like a bunch of arms coming out of their body and like trying to attach to my throat or to my chest? Or is it just a apparition, like a field of energy? Yeah. For me, it's been a wild ride seeing these reoccurring characters pop up and interacting with them and seeing how they evolve. But the way I've been trying to fight back against it is by learning who they are, documenting them, and exploring how they change, what they look like, how do they look like in this dream? What did they say to me in this dream? And for me, it gives them less power. I call it the fear cycle, where if you feed this experience fear and they're terrified, they kind of grab that energy and they spit it back out at you. But if you make it your mission when you go into sleep paralysis to pinpoint who they are and try to ask a question or break down that fear, you can go in there and observe and learn and take back information into the conscious world. And for me, that's given me a lot of power.
Now, if you're anything like me, even just you and I sharing these experiences right now, I feel a little bit of trepidation because I know that this is a kind of invocation. Because I hadn't had a sleep paralysis experience for a while until I grabbed your deck. And once I started emailing with you and it came back. And like, while we're talking, I'm getting chills right now. Like, it's like tonight, it's coming tonight. It kind of feels like that. But I mean, I don't think I have as sophisticated a way of dealing with it as you seem to have. But yeah, well, why don't we talk about the cards themselves and your process? So this deck was created during the pandemic, as I understand it, right? And interestingly enough, this is another sort of synergy between you and I, is that this podcast started during the pandemic because I was in a situation where work was precarious and actually not kind of happening. So I started doing some creative work and voila, we have this. You created the tarot deck. What happened for you? And maybe you can kind of give us a sequence of events that occurred back then.
I can absolutely resonate with what you just said because the pandemic started. I'm a self-employed artist and all of a sudden all the work stops. My gallery closes. Nobody's buying prints of artwork. And I was quite frankly terrified and I didn't know what was going to happen with my career, for example, or I didn't know if the world was going to end. It was a very uncertain time. So I'm sitting in my art studio trying to figure out what I'm going to do while this is all happening. And I was thinking a lot about my life and about spirituality, for example, and stumbled upon that memory of my Yaya and the tarot deck. And a lot of people in college and in high school had shown me tarot, especially the Suit of Swords, because I love medieval history. I love swords and martial arts and such. So they had always, why don't you try to recreate one of these pictures? They're really cool. I always loved them, never did it, but I had so much time during the pandemic that I just dove headfirst into researching tarot and learning about the archetypes and exploring who's the hermit, who is the emperor. And before I knew it, like doing this research, I'm looking at the research, I'm looking at my dream journals and I'm saying, wow, there's a lot of cross threads that are happening here from experiences I see in sleep paralysis versus what's been documented in the tarot through history. I started sketching and looking through my journals and finding, oh, this sketch kind of reminds me of the Empress, or maybe this scenario I created here reminds me of what the tower is like. And before I knew it, after a month of research, I was like, I think I can do this. I think I can explore and possibly make my own tarot deck. I had all the time in the world with the pandemic, everything closing. I live on Long Island, so it's pretty remote over here with lots of beaches, marshlands, woods. And I'm often out there exploring for ideas anyway. So I spent the whole month sketching, planning, figuring out what characters would stand in for certain scenarios. How am I going to get horses for characters? How many types of fabric I'll need? Like what colors? Old dresses for the female characters. It was a lot of planning because I wanted to create something that was not just like, oh, he tried to make the tarot or redo it, but something that was a usable tool for people to dive into, explore their subconscious, their dreams, their nightmares, and come out with a way to not just understand them, but maybe take a hold of it themselves and make themselves into a self-portrait of one of their dreams. Because I think art therapy is like the most important thing. It's the most accessible therapy there. So I just started working, creating these photographs over the pandemic. And I created the last photograph at, I think it was the end of November of 2020. And I finished 78 photographs over that whole entire span.
Is it just you working or did you have helpers or friends involved?
I normally work by myself, but I do sometimes have people, for example, my sister, my fiance, a couple of my close best friends, anyone who really has been with me since I was 14 and experiencing these sleep paralysis experiences, I feel comfortable having them in part of my repertoire of the work, like where they're coming in and maybe becoming one of the female characters because I can't do that. Or I'll have one of my best friends on the side there to make sure I don't pass out when I'm hung upside down doing a hang shot. It's more like a safety thing, or if they can be my eyes, if I'm shrouded and covered or I'm in the middle of a pond in the middle of February. It's awesome to have people who love me and that I care about in this process. And I keep it close to that circle of close friends and family for that reason.
And that's great because it's almost as if you're processing it in the third dimension with the people who are most involved with you emotionally and have a stake in your life. That's great. Adam or Will, do you have anything?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that was really... one of the things that really sort of stuck with me looking through the cards was, as he was mentioning, the facelessness of these sleep paralysis. They're often, I mean, typically called demons, let's say entities for the sake of impartiality, let's say. And then what I think is interesting about the absence of the face is that insofar as these things appear within this sort of liminal space between waking and being asleep, that there are so many different mechanisms of experience that are operating at this point. The absence of the face, for me, shows that the ethical dimension is absent. I think about the absence of a face, and I think about the work of a philosopher like Immanuel Levinas, who presents the face-to-face encounter as the fundamental ethical experience that lets us serve one another and recognize each other as people and ethical agents without reducing the other to some sort of flat equality. To be treated ethically, it doesn't have to be the same as you. But regarding the facelessness of these entities, that is a problem. You don't want, I think, when I've heard friends describe their experiences, one of sort of the original shocks is, what is this thing and what does it want? What does it want from me? And how do I have, I can't have an ethical relation to this thing. It's an invader. It has transgressed into my sort of waking up time and is now making makes demands on me, sometimes makes no demands. And if it makes no demands, maybe that's even more terrifying because you're stuck there in that ambiguous suspense. And insofar as, you know, the existence or the ontology of these entities is itself ambiguous, I just wanted to ask sort of how this facelessness works for you in the creation of the tarot deck and to what extent. No, I mean, you already mentioned the ethical sort of relation of working through your own psyche, not only by yourself, but with a community, with family, with friends. But also, how does this relate to the ambiguous existence of the entities you're portraying and embodying themselves?
Yeah, the faceless part of it really got to me, especially when I first started having the experiences, because like I want to know who it is or what it is standing in my room. Is it a demon? Is it one of my loved ones from thousands or hundreds of years ago trying to communicate with me now, and I have this ability to see it? Is it a scientific thing where energy is manifesting itself and there's like a rip in the spot time space continuum and something's coming through? It's all very perplexing. And but I think the symbol of having the no face in the work, it allows people to enter the work themselves. It allows people to see the figure that's shrouded as something that's otherworldly, and we don't have that ability to connect with it on the way that we as humans do. And it also allows me too to become these characters myself as part of the therapy, where it's like I can become the protagonist or antagonist. I can see what it feels like to be the shrouded rider in the death image here. And I can sit on the open ocean on top of a horse and stare into the endless horizon and imagine what it's like to be the messenger of death. To me, it's a really unique personal experience to take this situation where I have no control and then go out, recreate it, experience a lot of the things that I feel during sleep paralysis, but in the waking world, such as when I'm covered in a sheet for one of these photographs and it's soaked, I'm almost like waterboarding myself in a way, and it feels like I can't breathe. And again, I'm living through this experience in sleep paralysis too, but I have the ability to exit this experience anytime I want, and then also showcase it to the world and have people see what it's like to have sleep paralysis. It's really the anonymous part is a helpful motif, not just visually, but for me, it allows me to put on a mask and explore these characters in a way that I could never do just by talking about them or sketching them in my notebook.
And absolutely comes through regards to, you mentioned Caspar David Friedrich as an influence, because, you know, the iconic center of his most iconic painting is, of course, you know, the Wander Above the Sea of Clouds, which any of our listeners who have picked up a not necessarily an academic copy of any of Nietzsche's books, so we usually have it on the front cover. And the ultimately the protagonist is itself a canvas of that painting. There's not really any, there are gendered clothing and gendered signifiers, but ultimately it is a kind of blank canvas. Yet anything you can't really identify with, of course, is the limits of skin tone and hair, maybe, but there is this, the central blank space of identification where there's what isn't shown within the canvas itself becomes a kind of space of mimesis, or we can sort of mimic or implant or transplant yourself or translate yourself really into this picture. So yeah, I just wanted to pick up on the Friedrich because that really struck me.
While painting can also be substituted for the Fool, for example, they're very similar in the Rider-Waite Smith deck if you put them side by side, where character above the sea, is he ready to jump? Did he lose his lover, or is he just wondering at the amazement of the world and nature? So it's funny to learn about tarot, learn about the archetypes and the history of how these characters were created, and then compare them to popular culture or art itself throughout history. And there's so many underlying threads, and it's almost like you're seeing the binary code of how humans develop art, you know? That, at least for me, that's how it feels like.
You know, as somebody who has cloven themselves to the discipline of philosophy, I vacillated in my life back and forth between tryst with mysticism and what have you, and just hard reason in the books, in the classroom, in school. And when, like this tarot project for me, the Philosopher's Tarot, I did these as memes initially. And then people are like, oh, when are you going to do the whole deck? And I'm like, I'll do like one or two more. And then once I ended up doing the entire major arcana, I was like, that's it. I'm not doing any more, I promise. And, but of course, you kind of get sucked into this. And so I wanted to ask about, it's such an incredible, whether you're a skeptic or whether you have a cultivated interest in the tarot, once you start researching this, you see the incredible it's almost like the connective tissue, not only of Western thought, but of, you know, so many mystical traditions. Everything's kind of like overlaid or superimposed upon one another. And especially once we get to the latter part of the 19th century, and then with, you know, Waite and Smith in the early part of the 20th century, they're curating these images and essentially creating like a pantheon of archetypes that now we all identify with. And I was curious about like your journey into the tarot. What was that like? Maybe you can talk to us about like certain cards that you identify with. When we think of sleep paralysis, what is the sleep paralysis card? What is the Nicholas Bruno card? Maybe you could say a few things about that.
Yeah, sure. So again, like the way I looked at tarot originally as a high school student, I thought it was something that people just used for witchcraft. I never really knew anything about it except for my girlfriend, who's now my fiance. One of her cousins introduced me to it, and she did a reading for us on her kitchen floor. And I was like, oh crap, am I going to get possessed by a demon now? I was very scared about it. But after looking at it and seeing the tradition behind it and how far back the cards go and how this tradition has stayed and it's been used in so many different ways, it, as an artist, I'm like, there has to be a reason why artists are making this type of deck all throughout history. And that really just captivated me. Mm-hmm. And learning about the meanings behind each one, like for example, the hermit really jumped out to me because I love going into my studio and being isolated, and I'll be up at 2 a.m. just like sketching or figuring out how am I going to build this prop, for example, or how can I turn this feeling I had sleep paralysis into a visual motif? So I loved that card the most. That was really something that resonated with me. And also the Ace of Swords, just that hand with the sword and the plume of smoke happening behind it, that really captivated me. Well, and that card's about action and just going out there and creating these things. And that's kind of how I feel, where no one's going to create these photographs for me. And no one's going to help me get better. They're not going to hold my hand through it. I just have to go in there with my sword and be courageous and just go out into the middle of a pond somewhere and set up the scene and take a risk. And sometimes the risk doesn't pay off and I have to recreate an image two or three times in a row. But at the end of the day, you finally have something that's unique and you can share with the world. And I felt that creating this deck was a risk because I never thought I could create 78 images in 1 year. I normally make one image every month, for example, but I just pushed myself and just spent countless nights just building props. And if I'm not building props, I'm sketching out the next idea. If I'm not sketching out the next idea, I'm out there photographing and I'm trying to do two or three photographs in one day. Yeah. I was completely immersed, and tarot was really just a springboard for that. I was really, really excited to explore it.
I'm with you. And I think here's just another synergy, because the card in the deck that I think that I'm most drawn to is the Hermit card. That, and then number two would be perhaps the Magician. But with that said, now that the deck is created, it's almost like creating your own philosopher's stone in a sense. Now you have this item, this artifact. What are some ways that you use it for yourself that might be unconventional? Or do you do readings every day? Or what are the kinds of questions that you tend to ask your own deck?
So when I first got the sample deck in the mail, immediately the first thing I did was lay out all the images and just compare and contrast and figure out what certain things resonate or what certain motifs pop up and connect with other cards. Mm-hmm. And I tried to build in a lot of that into the work as well, where it's like, if you pull the Fool, for example, here, we have a character, it's kind of hard to see, sorry, but there's a bed that's being pulled out the window pretty much, but it's tethered to an anvil. And this character here is holding his dream journal, and he's severed himself from that bed, and he's floating out the window into the unknown. And at the completion of the major arcana here, we have my younger sister, who is now holding that same journal and reading the experience of what it was like to transform himself throughout the major arcana.
Right. So yeah, could you just say a little bit more about that? Like the trumps, as they're called, or the major arcana, are a sequence that they're divided into three series.
Right. Yeah. So the grand scheme of life, it's like you're being born into this life and you're transforming and you're becoming who you were meant to be. And you have this grand completion at the end, which is the world card. And traditionally in the card, there's a gigantic wreath around this nude figure. But in my card here, I have my younger sister who's been through every aspect of my life with me. And she's always been my support system. And she's now reading my experiences. And maybe she'll come down from this bed and have a conversation with me about what it was like to transform yourself through being the Fool who's sad, or maybe he's intrigued or mystified by what's about to happen to him in this out of body / sleep paralysis experience. So it was a cool dialogue to make cards that connect with each other and symbols that appear within each other. And some of them jumped out to me at my gallery opening when I showed all these photographs, where a gallery patron would point something out. I'm like, wow, I didn't even mean to do that. But subconsciously, it makes sense. So I think I got possessed in a way where it's like, it just kind of came out of me. I spilled it onto a canvas and I'm still learning things to this day that make sense with each other.
Maybe you could say a few more things about what are folks' common reactions to this sort of thing? And has there been like feedback from fans?
I think what's the best part about this is putting this project out there, not as necessarily a spiritual tool. I mean, of course you can use it like that, but I found that especially my younger followers who want to learn more about nightmares and dreams, they come to this and relate to it because kids have wild dreams. Teenagers have wild dreams. And the way I created this, it's not too like not safe for work for a teenager to look through and use as like an art inspiration tool or an art therapy tool. And it actually helped a lot of therapists that have reached out to me where they use this in their practice, where they give these to their clients and they look through the deck and they figure out what they resonate with, what they don't resonate with. Have you seen this character before in your nightmares? So it's really opened up to the people that I've wanted to open up to the most, who are teenage kids who are going through either really, really tough times or having sleep disorders or depressed, anything like that. And the people who are helping those kids who are the art therapists. And I'm glad that I created this tool and it can go out there and not just become how to read your fortune. It's something more than that. And anybody who's not even spiritual can take this deck and maybe pull something unique from it.
Once again, I just have to say that the creation of my deck in some ways brought together the community of listeners and followers that we have. And it's just incredible. You know, we have a saying on our podcast and in the sort of philosophy that we're most involved with that, you know, it's almost as if this deck was its own kind of machine. A machine that brought everyone together, that like, I wasn't the person who wrote all of these things. I kind of checked in with folks. I'm like, hey, how's this? How's that? You know, it was a collective endeavor at the end. And it's interesting how it creates kind of a membrane then that keeps a community together. And it's also the sort of crucible where we can work on creating meanings or processing certain kinds of, you know, events or uncertainties that we might have. Before we almost just about wrap up, Adam or Will, do you have anything that you wanted to throw in?
I mean, I'd quite like the resonances of using this therapeutically to sort of give like not a catalog, but a menagerie of various different entities one may encounter in sleep paralysis. It reminds me a lot actually of some of the 17th century grimoires around demonology, which mostly the Lesser Key of Solomon, which most people know due to its association with Crowley, and Crowley, a figure with, understandably, massive problems. And he does write an interesting preface. He says that he thinks that demons are like different portions of the human brain or something like that. And it's just a way of giving like a catalogue of various different aspects of personality, or there are various different aspects in which one can experience personality. And I think you'd probably best to go for like a post-Jungian like James Hillman or getting Grant Maxwell or Daleks, because the Gods episodes, listeners, if you haven't checked that out, it's very much in this wheelhouse. But yeah, I like the idea of collecting a sort of a menagerie or sort of an accounting for various entities that could be met with in these different kinds of, as we would say, inner experience. It is entirely internal, even when it presents this internal play of the various ways in which we could relate to the external world and it could relate to us. But our habits of experiencing the world flattened out all of these flurries of sense in such a way that we can't experience them until we're in that liminal space when things are just rebooting again.
I just have to say, you know, on this podcast, we have folks with varied interests philosophically. And my guess is that Will is the most skeptical among us when it comes to tarot and things of this sort. However, I'm not going to out Will completely. I know he's been contending with some nightmares recently, but I didn't know if you wanted to open up. Maybe we could draw a tarot card for Will and like maybe do a little reading or something.
I'm not a reader myself, but I could definitely pull a card.
Oh, let's do it. I'm a reader.
Sure.
I'm going to do it for Will right now.
Okay. Do you want me to do it?
Yeah, just go ahead and pull one card out and let's see what we got. And you can sort of venture your own interpretation based on the meanings as you understand them. Let's see what we got. Here we are. Oh, and I love the backing of your cards. That's great. It's just great. What do we got? Oh, yes, the Star.
That's a great card to pull.
Yeah. And you know what? I think this is a good one for Will to have. First of all, it's a major arcana card, right? And so there's an intensity here that I think is operative. And one of the things that, and Will, I think this is a great card for you to meditate on. It is the Star, right? Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it is. This is a card about rejuvenation, right? And this could be one of the readings and finding that sort of rejuvenating flow that sort of brings you back on board, especially once you have been enervated by all of the things in life that are tugging at you, the emotional anxieties, this and that. I don't know. What do you have, Nicholas? What's your connection with this card?
So I created this image for the Star where I have this cloaked figure here and It's like 2 a.m. and he's coming on the cusp of this horizon of snow and he's looking at, it could be daybreak, it could be the glow of the moon, but For me, it's a self-portrait where I'm up at 2 a.m. and I had a horrible sleep paralysis experience, but I'm out wandering around in nature because that's what makes me feel good. And I can be introspective and learn and then think about the next day and how I can be better the next day and take control of my life and do something awesome.
Ah, so for those of us who while away the hours of the earliest of morning, 1 a.m., 2 a.m., this is in the midst of all of that sort of tapping into something that's going to be a bit more positive, perhaps, than good. There's a lot to work with here, but Will and I will have a little private after this and we'll work on this card. Will, any comments on that?
Sure. I mean, there certainly is, like, especially for that one dream that we spoke of about the train.
Oh,
right? There's a kind of interesting, again, like returning to liminality, right? Rejuvenation necessitates a kind of limit, right? So like in order for rejuvenation to take place, one has to sort of enter a particular threshold. So I don't do dream interpretation, like,
you're doing it right now.
Criticism is not really like a thing for me, but I guess I could give a brief synopsis of the dream because we spoke about it for like an hour.
Sure.
Like I'm in this train. I think it's in the New York Metro. I don't know. Like if I had to place it, I would probably say like it's probably like the Atlantic Terminal, and I'm on a train, and strangely this like very feminine but semi-robotic voice says, "Welcome to Acid Horizon." The train is absolutely illuminated, like with almost like classroom style lights. I don't know if anybody remembers the violence of how your classroom was lit, especially if you were like in trouble. And where the tension, the really brutal nature of the lighting as you looked outside and it's like pitch black and yet it's really illuminated. And I'm on this train just like absolutely alone. I don't know if it's off peak or not. Like, I don't know if that's relevant, but I'm on this train alone. But there's a ton of baggage, like there's luggage everywhere, but stored away neatly. And it's all that like hard plasticky luggage, you know, like the Away bags. Those were really popular in like 2018. Mm-hmm. Like, so that's the dream, and it bothered me. Like, it ruined my day. I don't know why. It seems like a really benign thing, but
it seems pretty positive, minus being stuck in New York trains, because New York City, you're awful. But it's like you're going on a journey and you're bringing all these ideas with you onto this podcast, and you're moving slower. You're not going backward. You're not driving off a cliff. It's a direct path and you have a destination. So for me, at least, it seems positive, even though it might be a little unknown or scary as to who's piloting it or where you go, but there's a destination and there's one track. At least for me, it seems positive.
I appreciate that interpretation. I don't know what mine is. I was just left deeply unsettled.
I just thought it was a scene from Neon Genesis Evangelion when he's just on the train running from the giant task of the robot/podcast for having to pilot Will. Get in the podcast, Will, or Craig will have to do it again.
Well, Nicholas, just one more question for you before we break off here. I absolutely love the tarot deck. My wife is a tarot skeptic, but she loves when I do readings with this deck for her. So what are some future projects or offshoots to this project that we can expect down the line? I know that you have drawn, like a hand-drawn version of your deck that you did over the summer or something, right?
Right. Yeah. So I explored my original photography deck and I created this series of drawings where I went through and redrew each of the photographs from the series. And it allows you to go through my photography deck, but in a new way and learn about the symbolism. It pops out a little bit easier and a little bit more accessible visually. And it was something I've always wanted to try. And it will be, the deck should be here this summer and I'll be shipping them out then. They're currently being proofed. And another thing that's cool is my new video documentary will be out and I'm going to be releasing information on my Facebook and on my Instagram. We created it's around 12 minute long video documentary. It's not necessarily like an interview, but more of an art film. And premiering this at a really cool film festival that will be shown worldwide. And I can't wait for everybody to see it.
Excellent. And we have some folks who are experiencing this podcast just by audio. So I'll make sure to put links in the show notes so that anyone who wants to access the images or even this video can certainly do that. His name is Nicholas Bruno. It is the Somnia Tarot, self-produced. He has a Patreon account, I gather, right?
I'm just on Instagram, but you can
support Instagram
if you'd like. That would be really helpful.
Great. Thanks. Yeah. I will throw the Instagram in the show notes as well. And it was a real pleasure having you. I absolutely love this deck and it's actually deepened my interest and enthusiasm for tarot. So thanks for joining us on the show today.
Yeah, thank you guys so much.